Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover. Today's guest, New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu. We caught up with him in Miami Beach, where he had just become officially president of the Conference of Mayors, which is a bipartisan, nonpartisan group of all the mayors around the country, about 1,500 of them, Republicans, Democrats, people who were elected in nonpartisan elections. Landrieu gave a speech as he took over that had a lot in it about the role that he thinks mayors have to play at this particular moment, including this line: American greatness is alive and well in cities and towns across the country, from urban to rural to suburban, from coast to coast. As I said to him in the interview, when you talk about American greatness, it's pretty clear he's talking about President Trump and his response to what he sees out of the White House, out of Congress, out of Washington overall. And as you'll hear, he was pretty firm in his argument that there is not much to be counted on coming out of Washington. And that's why you need, in his opinion, mayors who are talking about things not through the political spectrum, but through what actually gets done. We also talked a lot about a speech that he delivered earlier this year when he removed the last of the Confederate monuments from New Orleans. There were death threats, he said. There were city contractors who were refusing to work on it. But to him, it was a lesson about what can happen, the way that there's more there than maybe people have anticipated. It also was to him a lesson about what mayors can do, that there was a speech that he gave as the mayor of New Orleans about a local issue, Confederate monuments in his city, that became a national issue. And to the mayors, he said that is a promise of just how much they can get done and how much of a role they can play in the national conversation. Fascinating conversation after a long weekend for him going through all of this that ended in a party on Sunday night that he got up on stage and played the washboard for, really getting in touch with the New Orleans spirit. Remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or whatever your favorite podcast platform is. Follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover and on Facebook, and email me your thoughts and suggestions at isaac@politico.com. And now, our conversation with Mayor Mitch Landrieu. So should we call you Mr. President now?
I'm happy to be president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors.
You just finished delivering your inaugural speech and laid out a pretty ambitious agenda there. One of the things you talked about was your speech about the Confederate monument removal a couple months ago, which was something that all around the country people were thinking about, and you took a lot of people by surprise. With
me included.
What does it tell you about the political moment that we're in, the conversation that's going on, the way that that was received?
Well, first of all, that's a very complicated subject. As you know, I've been in office for 30 years. I've given a lot of speeches. I thought some of them were pretty good. None of them have gotten picked up and had a virtuous cycle of repetition like this one did. So it told me a couple things. First of all, the issue of race is still very important to the people of the country, and somehow the speech struck a nerve. I can't say in an unintentional way, but the audience that it touched was unintentional. I was really speaking to New Orleans and the historical record. But for purposes of this speech, the reason I articulated that to mayors was fortuitous, because today Mike Bloomberg said that he's going to invest another $200 million in making sure that cities find ways to be innovative and work. And the story that's important here is that when I first got elected, Mike Bloomberg was one of the first people that I went to go see. I went to go see Richard Daley and Mayor Menino and a bunch of other folks to try to learn from the best what I was supposed to do. And Mike told me, he said, get a good scheduler, and he said, do all the hard things first. And then he told me another thing that I'll never forget. He said, you know, mayors limit themselves. He said, actually, there are only two things mayors cannot do. And I was curious about this. He said, we can't sign treaties, and we can't declare war. And he said, other than that, there's no limit on our power absent what our respective charter said. And so he then began to put his money where his mouth is and then prove to everybody that if we began really to think about our individual power and the things we can do with new technology and innovation in cities, and if we did it all together, and if we all learned from each other across a whole bunch of different platforms, which he has now subsequently created and turned into real things with real names, and we learn big things and basic things like how you pick up the garbage, what's the best way to collect on fees that erode, how you better deliver a service to the people, how you use technology to make people's lives better against whatever subject matter you want, healthcare, education, the climate, that if we act locally in unison, we can actually create national policy. And it doesn't have to be federal. And so this whole concept, which I don't think the country has keyed in on yet, we used to call it new federalism or federal, et cetera. That's not the way mayors are thinking anymore. We want the federal government to be our partner. We don't want a handout from them. We know what the model is that works best. But what Mike has shown us, and all the mayors subsequently have begun to prove, is that if we act locally and we do it in unison, we can actually create a national policy.
But let me bring you back to that speech, though. Was it just because it was about race? Why did that break through,
well,
do you think?
I want to separate these two things. I'll come back to that. But what I was trying to say to the mayors today is one of the things that's noticeable about that speech, and there are many things that are, is that a mayor spoke and the country listened. And what I was trying to say to them is we now know after 7 years of intense work with Mike and a whole bunch of other people that people now are looking to mayors, which is a strange thing because they generally look to governors or United States senators or to presidents or to, you know, historians, whatever. And most people think, well, people don't listen to mayors. The world is changing. And that's because not just power, but responsibility is devolving. And I think somebody showed me some polling data yesterday that when you ask the public, who do you trust most? The closer you get to the ground in terms of elected officials, and we're the closest besides school board members, they have much more trust in municipal leaders than they do in governors or Congress or the presidency. And so the point that I was trying to make to the mayors is that there is a moment that we have to recognize, and that if you shouldn't assume that just because it was me and it was a special message, that that's the only time it will resonate. In fact, if mayors confront really important things, people will listen. And you don't have to say, well, I'm just a mayor, so I can't talk. You really have to think about the power and the responsibility that you have. Now, on the second piece of it, I think race is a very troubling issue for the people of America. And I think that we'd like to believe that we're in a post-racial America or that we're not racist or that, you know, maybe we're better than we are. And I think that that issue really struck a lot of people for a couple of different reasons. I think that people who were not listening because they never thought about them like I never thought about them, that when I called the question on it and all of the people came out and spoke in a very hateful way, people began to say, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that that's what that was. How many other things have I walked by and not thought about? And it woke us up to issues of other, what other Americans had. And I think it called people into a moment of reflection, and it troubled them because of the what they saw on the streets of New Orleans and thought, wait, I didn't realize that we were still stuck at this point in time. And the other thing that was important about it is that the speech was an invitation for people to think. It wasn't a condemnation. And as I said in the speech, we all take our own path on race. And so although it was, people say, I divided the country by giving the speech, I didn't divide the country. I didn't start the Civil War.
You pointed out the divisions.
I was pointed out the divisions, and of course they manifest themselves immediately and confirmed.
But you were called, some people called you a Nazi, some people called you a Marxist, right? It was a full range of it. What is that just because our discourse, first of all, you can't, I don't think it's possible to be a Nazi and a Marxist simultaneously, but we can leave that to the political scientists to work out. It seems like it's a strange thing that you make a speech about Confederate monuments, and that's where the conversation goes to.
Well, I want to point out what may not be obvious to the people who watched and listened. First of all, most of the people in New Orleans wanted those monuments down. I know that. I'm the mayor of the city. I walk in the neighborhoods all the time. I'm really, really sure about who New Orleans is, what our history is, and who we really want to be, which is a reflection of who we've always been. And those monuments were an aberration in terms of a reflection of what the soul of the city was. That's first. The second thing is that most of the people, even those who were against it, were not hateful and mean. But there were strains that came out of nowhere relating to the Confederate monuments that have been with us for a long time. And I think the country looked at it and said, wow, I didn't realize we were still in that much of denial, or we will completely not listen to the facts. Now, one of the things I've learned from this is that race cuts really, really deep. And
you didn't know that before?
Well, I did know it, but I thought after South Carolina, and I had been thinking of this well before then.
You mean with the Confederate flag coming?
Yeah, but when South Carolina happened and Dylann Roof killed those 9 beautiful fellow Americans, that the country finally said to itself, you know what, now is the time. We can't look away from this, and we know what the truth is. And I miscalculated that. I would have done it anyway, but I really did think that it was not going to dig up the kind of vitriol and the intentional intimidation, nor did I think that I would find as much institutional bias as I found, which manifests itself to me just in the very simple act of trying to get a crane to take the monuments down. That surprised me, and it bothered me tremendously. And it is confirmation that institutional racism continues to exist, some of which is really aggressive, which is, I will never let you use anything, even though I'm a city contractor. If I disagree with you, too, I'm afraid because I might get hurt. And it was very much real, without me exaggerating it, to the kind of intimidation that existed back in the day when they burned crosses on people's lawns. It's just another form of intimidation. And we were not going to submit to it because we took a legitimate government action after a democratic process. And that would have been terrible if we would have succumbed to that intimidation.
After everything that was dredged up during the 2016 election, and there was a lot of hatred that seemed to come out, and people flaring up in all sorts of ways, even after that, it surprised you that
you put the line back in South Carolina,
which is two years ago.
Yeah,
right?
Remember, this is really hard to get your brain around, but we started this well before the presidential race even kicked up. This was before Hillary Clinton really ever announced that she was running. So we started this a long, long time ago. You know, as the election unfolded and as we saw the really difficult stuff happening during the presidential campaign, it became really obvious that this was going to be a much, much hotter moment than we thought. Now, I can't honestly tell you that I have empirical data to show that the election caused the problem, but it was clear that after the election, this nation was in a heightened state of anxiety that contributed to the freedom that people felt to be really nasty and really mean and really intimidating. And by the way, on both sides, when we, I should say that another way, not necessarily on both sides relating to the issue of the Confederacy, but the alt-right, and then, of course, this other group that were anarchists. What's the name of it?
Antifa.
So the alt-right and Antifa, which I'm not sure had anything specifically to do with the specific issue of the Confederate monuments, but was just looking for a place to cause agony. They were present on the streets of New Orleans too, and that became a combustible set of circumstances. So again, I know you can look at a geographical setting and see a bunch of people yelling at each other. You can see a bunch of flags, but until you start looking at the specific flags, you might not clearly see that it wasn't just the issue of the Confederacy. It was also some of the leftover agony that you saw just a month earlier in Berkeley and in other areas. And listen, to our police department's credit and to the community's credit, they did a good job of maintaining peace. They were, but there were death threats and there was bad stuff.
Were you scared personally?
No, I wasn't scared, but that doesn't mean I wasn't aware of the threats.
Were there threats to you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there were very serious national security and homeland security issues, which is why we took the monuments down when and how we did. That was all driven by security recommendations and concerns.
I want to turn to something you said in your speech. American greatness is alive and well in cities and towns across the country, from the rural to suburban, from coast to coast. America, great. They put those together. It seems like you're responding to President Trump.
I'm doing is directly challenging what the word great means. You know, the president used the phrase make America great again. And of course, people go, well, I don't understand the again thing. Like, when was that? And that, of course, throws us immediately into where are you going back to? What are you thinking about, et cetera, et cetera. And the president although he's curbed this language a bit, has condemned American cities as pits of bad stuff and corruption. And that is just empirically not true. That we are the host of most of the people that live in this country. So obviously, when you walk into a city, they're going to be neighborhoods that are a certain way, neighborhoods that are another way. But by and large, the cities in America are the places where people work, where they live, where we worship. You can find the best that America has to offer in cities, and it's great stuff, no matter how you cut it. And if you go put a magnifying glass on one neighborhood in one city and then run the numbers on that, you could turn that into a picture that's not generally true, which is not to say that we don't have a lot of tough issues, my city being a perfect example. I don't think anybody can look at my city and say we don't have a lot of things that we have to fix. But you also can't look at my city and say, gosh, after the devastation of Katrina and Rita, those people have really done a spectacular job of rebuilding their healthcare system, their education system, their port, building a new airport. I mean, if you want to see how infrastructure investment actually changed lives and creates jobs, come to the city of New Orleans. It is at once a great example of how America has always been great. Now, if you want to see difficulties, you can come there too. And mayors have to deal with those complicated issues all at once, all at the same time. And so I was just trying to kind of paint the picture for America that there are wonderful things happen in little towns and cities all across the country, and that is absolutely true.
But he's wrong, and you're...
I think that the president is wrong often. He is wrong most of the time because he takes a myopic, narrow view. Now, somebody...
Are you saying that as a Democrat?
I mean, I'm saying it factually. I'm saying this as a fact-based matter, that when you make blanket statements about Muslims are dangerous, you know, or refugees will kill you, or X people because they wear a certain thing will do this to you, or cities are bad, that even if there is a kernel of truth about that, it doesn't make the whole thing truth. And perspective and facts are really important. And so, you know, the president publicly will say bad things about the city, but in private, he will say, I love cities. And so, I'm not speaking in opposition to him, or I would have invoked his name. What I was doing was telling the story as I know it, telling the story that I can testify to because I see mayors around America doing terrific things in small towns and in big towns. And you can find America's greatness on any day at any time in an American city. And I think people are smart enough to understand the nuances of that and the dynamism that we see all over America. And by the way, this rural-urban divide, which all of you spend a lot of time talking about, if you really think about how much we depend on each other, you can actually see how rural America is tied to urban America and vice versa, just in the chain of fishermen in the Gulf providing the fish that Galatoire serves. And so all the way from the rural area where the food or the fish or the kind of raw material is harvested, how their livelihood depends on the businesses and cities really, really working, farm to table. This is just one example. There are a million. So the country is much like an iPhone in terms of being designed where parts come from all over the place to form one thing. The same thing is true about the supply chains across America. So I know people are going to continue to try to pull us.
Slave labor.
Yeah, well, what I'm saying is that America is the formation of a lot of different parts coming from a lot of different things. And this notion that somehow the people in rural America can stay disconnected from the people in urban America is not the whole story. We are connected to each other. We're interdependent. And the more we talk about that, the more we can just address where the real problems are and whether they're actually made up or whether they're wider than we think they are.
You seem like you don't want to be a leader of the resistance, right?
I don't. Look, mayors cannot afford to be the leader of a resistance. We don't see ourselves that way. That's a question that's out of our minds in many ways. Let me give you an example. Let's use a tough issue. If the president came to the mayors of America and said, I have a problem. I need to build a wall. The first reaction that mayors would have is not the one that the folks in Washington have, which is, well, let's have a fight about the morality of immigration. We could get to that eventually. But the first thing that a mayor would ask would, well, where's that wall going to go? How long does it have to be? How deep does it have to go in the ground? What are you going to make it out of? How are we going to pay for it? Who's going to build it? When do you want to start? When do you want to end? We ask very practical questions like that. And while we're doing that, we get into the issues of, well, really, is this the best way? What are you trying to accomplish? And is there a better way to do it? And we would let a lot of those practical considerations get folded into the larger issue of, for example, on healthcare, do you believe that healthcare is a right for every American, which drives everything else? And so, again, mayors, both Republicans and Democrats, really are practical on the ground builders rather than destroyers. So if our approach generally on healthcare would be like, well, wait a minute, I know what you guys are trying to do in the Senate this week, but didn't you guys say that Obamacare didn't work and they put it together the same way? So why are we doing that again? And we don't have the CBO score yet. And it looks like you're going to throw 20 million people off of healthcare. So besides the morality of that, tell us again, when all of those people in the cities don't have healthcare, where are they supposed to go? And how do we provide enough, you know, drug treatment centers and emergency rooms? How does that actually look? And if you don't have an answer for that, why are we doing this again?
Have you seen any level of practical thinking out of the White House of the kind that you're looking for?
No, I have not seen any of that. And I think that's what really frustrates mayors. And we want to be available. We want to be available with governors. We want to be available in partnership with the House and the Senate to actually sit down and have them come ask us really practical questions. Like when we, Senator X, say, ordain that this will be the policy and the president signs the bill, what is it going to look like on the street where you live? And because we can give them real life chapter and verse stories like this, that when the emergency room in the city of New Orleans at our public hospital gets filled up, then the wall time, quote unquote, wall time for our emergency medical folks that are actually picking up people that are overdosing on our streets increases from 24 minutes to an hour to 2 hours. And then when there is another incident, it's going to take that much longer, so people will actually die on the streets. Have y'all thought about that all the way down to the ground? And if you haven't thought about that, then this theoretical notion that we're going to block grant Medicaid to states without making sure that we have money is really kind of a theoretical fight for us.
But how do you, you are leading a conference that now has an agenda that is about climate change, it's about immigration reform, healthcare, infrastructure, that puts you in positions that are in opposition to the president, to the Trump administration. How do you avoid that becoming a political battle?
Well, first of all, that's not necessarily true. What we did was, and by the way, we started developing this agenda 2 years ago. We didn't just do this as a result of President Trump getting elected. What we did was we asked mayors across America, what are all the things that you're concerned about? Now, there are 1,400 cities that are part of who we are. There were 266 mayors here. We obviously can't deal with all of those issues. So we said, what are the four issues that we can all find common ground on to at least talk about? Now, we haven't, just because we are interested in healthcare, we haven't necessarily adopted the position that the Affordable Care Act is great and it doesn't need any changes. On infrastructure, we obviously have a very strong opinion that we build things on time, on task, on budget. And we can demonstrate in chapter or verse why mayors are the best, city halls are the best folks to give the money to, because we can get in the ground and create jobs and create opportunities for people better than anybody else. On climate change, I think that most of us are in agreement that climate change is real and that human beings contribute to it, and that there are lots of things that we can do to make sure that we make, you know, the air safe. So those things are not in opposition so much to President Trump. It's because, as I said, we were done before he got in office. But we're just testifying to what it is that we see. And we can communicate, by the way.
What's it tell you, though, that you have Republican mayors who signed on to that agenda when you have Republican members of the House and Senate?
Here's
and
what
a
it tells you.
This is
an easy answer. The Congress is out of touch with the American people, and that the congressional districts, the way they're cut, does not allow the what I call the radical middle to breathe and to speak. There are lots of congressmen and senators, if left to their own devices, that could come up with a solution that 65% of the American people would support on all of these issues. And the governors and the mayors are not susceptible to the same lines that congressmen are. So therefore, we don't have the same pressures and we have more freedom. I can't speak to the issue. I think there are lots of wonderful people who have been elected to Congress and the Senate that serve, but they're stuck. I can't unstick them. I don't know enough about how to tell them how to get unstuck, except to say, to have a bunch of courageous people in the middle that stand up and say, look, we've got to move the country forward. I can tell you this, if you poll it on any one of those issues, you can find consensus, even on immigration, which is the hardest one, for about, you know, 60% of the people. Listen, it seems to me that the agreement, there is a deal on the table right now that the American people have communicated that they will support. Democrats have to yield on this apparent notion that people have of them, that they're for open borders. They're not. I think everybody agrees that we have to have real borders, and you can't have a country without borders. Now, I think there's a disagreement about exactly how to secure the border, about whether you do it with a wall or somebody else, but most reasonable people think you can do it with technology and maybe more border control. I think everybody in the country on the Republican side now has agreed that the Dreamer kids are not going to be deported. I think we can all agree that we want to get violent criminals off the street, irrespective of their immigration status, but we don't want to scapegoat immigrants. And then I think that the hard part is how you create an environment where we handle 11 million people because nobody thinks we're going to deport them. Now, I happen to believe that if you put a bunch of thoughtful governors and thoughtful mayors in a room, that they could come up with a solution to that that a majority of the people in this country would support. Now, whether you could pass that through Congress or not is a different thing. But as I'm saying, is that their prism that they're looking at the American people from is different from the ones we look through.
One of the issues that strikes me always is, and you touched on it a little bit in your speech, you said we have to have a situation where the lives of young black men are valued, and also where we don't get into budget fights about the opioid crisis and actually get to. When you think about it in the terms of homeland security, though, right, what does it tell you when it's harder to get more funding for police through Washington or a response when there are incidents in cities than it is, obviously, when there's a terrorist attack?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, it's important to recognize that the word terror is very scary. We do have to protect ourselves on a national security front from a homeland security front. I believe strongly that we have to have a strong national defense. But it is, and this is not a partisan issue because Democrats and Republicans suffer from the same problem. This is more a federal, local issue about, well, somehow public safety is not federal, that's local. What mayors, Republican, and Democrats are beginning to communicate to Congress is something that is obviously true that they just do not understand. And it looks something like this, that the 800,000 police officers on the streets of America are the tip of the spear in protecting this country from national security threats, homeland security threats, and public safety. The world has changed very dramatically. You used to be able to break it up pretty easily, but now we're all the same. For example, in New Orleans, in fighting street crime, the multi-agency gang unit, which is an organization that's designed to go after the worst of the worst, gang members who are killing each other and other people, is made up of FBI, DEA, ATF, and New Orleans police officers that's run by my police chief. Well, that's an all-in-one, we're all in this together deal, and it has federal, state, and local resources in it. That is what's required to address that threat. When there is an attack on the homeland, and you're not sure what the origin of it was, and you have questions about it, like what was Orlando, what really happened in Boston, what happened in New York, and we begin to try to dissect whether it's a threat from outside or a threat from a homegrown terrorist, irrespective of what the impetus is, the first people on the ground are local police departments and local emergency centers, and by the way, our trauma centers. So now all of a sudden you say, well, wait, you called that terror, and so then what happens as a result of that? And what we're saying to the rest of America is that if in this new threat era that we have, that if you want to secure the homeland, you cannot just send money overseas, that you have got to give the kind of resources to the federal authorities, to the state authorities, and to the local authorities so that we can have fusion centers that can see, that can hear, that can talk to each other and protect ourselves, which is why we have advocated very strongly for an increase in the funding for police officers like they did back in 1996. That part of that crime bill was actually a good part so that we can have more police officers trained in community policing and trained in the kind of things that our federal partners are trained in. And that new threat requires a new response. And you have generals like Ray Odierno, who is talking all over the country about new security threats, cyber and other things, that hopefully will get Congress to think differently. Now, and I'll end with this, Congress always says, oh, well, no, because that's supposed to be local governing, and we don't spend money on police departments, and we don't spend money on schools, and we don't spend money on health clinics. And we say, oh, yes, you do. Go ask David Petraeus. When you guys were trying to fix what we broke overseas, there was a whole bunch of money in the Department of Defense budget, and we did those very things because the general said to us, if you want safety and security, you have to rebuild capacity on the ground. So if you're going to do it over there, why wouldn't you do it on this side of the pond so that we can have a full circle of security protection?
But it seems like where this leaves you, though, because you're not going to get magically all that happening in Congress, is to having to do a workaround, essentially.
Correct. That's true. Well, listen, let me say this. My view is that the country is really strong when the federal government, the state government, and the local governments are working in complete community, horizontally and vertically. All right, that's when we're the best. And we can demonstrate that 1,000 different ways. But if Washington's not going to show up, we cannot wait. We do have to work around them.
Is that and weird to you as a Democrat to say that?
No. It's really not, as I said, from a mayor's perspective, which is nonpartisan. What we're saying is we want you here. We need you here. But if you're not coming, we got to do two things. Either contain you, right, or get you off of us. Now, we know this because we've seen this from 1969 till today. When you look through the administrations of Richard Nixon to today. Ironically, Richard Nixon was really good for cities. He was one of the first presidents that understood that a partnership between the federal government and cities really mattered. And he created a lot of opportunities for us to work together. When Reagan came in office, he switched the model under this concept of new federal and said, no, I'm going straight to the states, which, of course, if you ever worked on the state level, and of course, I was lieutenant governor for 2 terms in Louisiana, anytime you give money to a governor, the governor's got the whole state to take care of. So you're going to bleed a third of that money off just because the politics dictates that you take care of the whole state, not just some of it. If you want to make meaningful impact on the ground, money goes directly to the cities that can then become the hubs for metropolitan areas. And if you do it the right way, you can actually take care of most of the state. Now, what's happening today, because Washington seems to be stuck, is that you have major players like Mike Bloomberg stepping in saying, we have got to find a way to be faster, more entrepreneurial, and more innovative, and that's what we're working through now.
You had a party last night for everybody who was at the conference.
Played a washboard on stage.
What did you play?
Oh, it was a Cajun song that we were playing, and the washboard is just it's a percussion right. instrument, you know, so it doesn't really matter what the song is. If you look like you're in rhythm, you look pretty good.
It's easy.
Yeah, it's easy, much easier than playing the guitar.
And I can't, you're going to tell me that I shouldn't ask you about this, but people around are talking about whether they should expect you to be running for president of not just the Conference of Mayors, but president overall.
What right. That's an easy answer. The answer is they should not. I'm not running for president. I have a year left in my term. We are curating the 300th anniversary of New Orleans. I'm going to be the president of the Conference of Mayors, and I don't really have any intention of doing that.
Not at all. I don't have any intention as one of those things.
Well, this is a game that everybody plays all the time. In politics, the appropriate answer is you never say never. Right. You never know what's going to happen or what God's going to call you to do at some point in time or where your family is going to be in those circumstances. But I'm not planning to run for president. I'm not running for president. I can't tell you if they offered me the job that I wouldn't take it, but that generally is never going to happen. You know, so
I don't plan.
I am not exactly, you know, which is, I don't know. But now I'm not running for president.
All right. Mayor Mitch Landrieu, thanks for taking the time.
All right. Thank you.
That was Mayor Mitch Landrieu coming to us from Miami Beach. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Bridget Mulcahy, and our intern, Rachel Cusick. Remember, of course, to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. Give us your thoughts. And make sure you're catching up with the latest episodes as they're coming. We've got great guests in the next few weeks. Senator Mike Lee, French Ambassador Giraud Arreau, and all sorts of others.